From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters, and it's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. We will get you updated on the news that made headlines this week around our region. And today, our panel includes Kevin Richert, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, Rachel Cohen, South Central Idaho reporter for Boise State Public Radio, Christina Lords, the editor-in-chief of the Idaho Capital Sun, Gretchen Parsons, managing editor with Boise Dev, and Ryan Supe, state politics reporter for the Idaho Statesman. Happy Friday, everybody.
Hello, happy Friday.
Hello.
Hello.
So, Rachel, let me begin with you, because this is a story that you've been reporting on, I believe, for about the past week or so. We did mention it a little bit here on Idaho Matters, but this has to do with quagga mussels having been found in the Snake River, and it's really putting the entire Pacific Northwest on alert. So, Rachel, why is this such a big concern, and what do we know as of this morning?
Yeah, so, again, the microscopic quagga mussel larvae, basically the baby mussels, were found in the Snake River early last week by Centennial Park in Twin Falls. It's a big deal because these mussels are incredibly invasive. They're pretty much everywhere else in the U.S. already, except the Pacific Northwest was kind of a holdout. And they're feared because they can do a lot of damage to infrastructure. And once they're found, they're really hard to get rid of. So for the past week and a half, you know, it's really been an urgent time frame because officials felt like they might have caught the issue early on. And if they did everything right, essentially, in the next few weeks, that maybe they had a shot at preventing it. And so, you know, state and local agencies have been trying to cut out the human factor because boats and kayaks are kind of typical vectors for these mussels, which love to latch onto any hard surface. So, you know, you have a 14-mile or so stretch of the river close to hunting and fishing, as well as nearby lakes. And, you know, that the agency is trying to decontaminate all the boats that have been in the stretch of the river. So they've set up 2 boat washing stations in Twin Falls. You know, it's kind of a big task. And at the same time, department staff have been actually in the river collecting hundreds of water samples because really how these baby mussels got in the river, how many there are, where they're originating from was really a mystery. In the time since, there have been some more answers to come out. ISDA says it seems like there's a population of these larvae hanging out near Shoshone Falls in particular. Mm. And, you know, that's, of course, the iconic Idaho waterfall that sometimes nicknamed the Niagara of the West. And it's about 4 miles upstream from where they were initially detected in Twin Falls. And, you know, as of today, some of those closures are being extended, and there's also new ones. Boise State Public Radio reporter James Dawson was at the Idaho Department of Fish and Game early this morning when there was a meeting about those closures. And it was reported that the ISDA has actually found 1 adult mussel. And those are, you know, the adults are the ones that have the hard shells. But we don't know much more about that at this time. What we do know is that ISDA is near finalizing a treatment plan to try to eradicate the mussels that are there. And this will most likely include introducing a chemical to the water. It hasn't been officially announced what that will be and exactly what the process will look like, but a chemical that was mentioned in that meeting is called Natrix. And Natrix is a copper-based pesticide that's actually intended for this very purpose, to control invasive mussels, snails, oysters. But of course, you know, introducing any chemical to the river certainly involves mm-hmm. trade-offs. And so that's kind of, those are the discussions that are going on between state, federal, local agencies right now. But in preparation, Twin Falls has actually closed the Shoshone Falls Park starting today to set the stage for this treatment. And the state will likely share more with the public about, you know, what the treatment will look like, exactly what it will mean for everyone in the community, probably early next week.
Okay. And so at this point, Rachel, do we know if they do have to use these chemicals, what that would potentially mean for other, I guess, like, you know, fish, other things like that in the river?
You know, I don't know exactly what it will mean. In some of the descriptions about Natrix, and again, the department has not officially announced that it's using this particular chemical yet. But, you know, yeah, there is definitely the possibility for it to kill native fish. And that might be a trade-off that the agency is weighing right now. As to other effects, I'm not exactly sure. It will probably depend on how far they're intending on or imagining that this chemical might be able to spread, if there's any shot at controlling it. And then, you know, you'll have to look at what sort of pipes or intakes are going into the river at that particular spot. Like, are people getting their irrigation water from this particular stretch? You know, how far away is the drinking water plant? So those are, you know, some things that I think the agency is probably thinking pretty hard about right now. And we might know more about it early next week.
Okay. Appreciate that update. Christina and Kevin, I want to bring you into the conversation because some shocking and devastating news over the weekend when we all learned of the sudden passing of JJ Saldana. And I would love both of you to kind of talk about who JJ was, the legacy that he leaves. And I know, Kevin, he really did do so much for education. But Christina, I'll start with you. For folks who may not be familiar with who JJ was, can you tell us a little bit, you know, about him and really his incredible impact on the state?
Sure. JJ, I think, is known to everyone and everyone knows JJ. And I think that's why we're seeing such an outpouring from dang near everybody on social media and the Latino community really grieve this leader within our state. JJ worked for almost 24 years at the Idaho Commission on Hispanic Affairs, and he died in his sleep of unknown causes on Friday morning. And he has been instrumental, and Kevin can talk a little bit more about this, but instrumental in establishing the Hispanic Youth Leadership Summit, which literally doles out millions of dollars to Latino high school students each year to ensure that they have access to college. He has worked tirelessly to establish the Idaho's Hispanic Heritage Month, which usually comes with a celebration in this in the state capitol, working with the governor's office and other cities to ensure that people understand Hispanic culture in Idaho. And he's been a real advocate for ensuring that Latinos are in Idaho newsrooms. And he served on the board of the VOCES Internship of Idaho, that places Latino college students in paid internships in Idaho newsrooms. And he really was a believer in that motto of you can't be what you can't see. And he worked like every day to make sure that Idaho's Latinos had access to some of these public services, jobs, ability to go to school. And, you know, the governor sent out a release, the Boise mayor sent out a release, you know, just really encouraging people to remember JJ and make sure that his legacy, you know, continues on. And I think I just don't see his influence waning anytime soon, even with his passing. And I think it's important to note that they are doing a celebration of life at Boise State Simplot Ballroom at Boise State University on Saturday, beginning at 12:30. And I think it'll be just a healing time for everybody who knew JJ, who had interviewed JJ, or who had worked alongside some of those causes in state politics.
Yeah. So Kevin, talk to us about really his influence from the educational standpoint, as Christina mentioned.
His impact on education was it was so profound. The centerpiece of it were these Hispanic Youth Leadership Summits that the commission held and continues to hold across the state. Students received over $14 million in scholarships at these summits last school year. And I had the chance to cover one a few years ago. They're really fun events. They're really cool events. And it's not just about the moment when these students receive scholarships, which is a life-changing moment, and make no mistake about that. It's really a chance for students to opened their eyes to new opportunities. It was really, I think for JJ, I think a lot of it was about, you know, like Christina said, the idea that you can't be what you can't see. So I think he wanted students to visualize college is something that's attainable. It's not just something for other kids in other households. It's something you can do too. And I think that's really such a big part of his legacy. And that's what I wanted to write about on Thursday. Where does this go from here? And just to shine a light on the impact that he had. And you know, just really quickly, you know, Christina mentioned it. Everybody's got a JJ story, you know, and I had to kind of step out of third person in my piece yesterday to kind of point it out. I mean, yeah, JJ was a source. He was a guy I had on my podcast quite a few times, but he was also somebody I just enjoy joking around with on Twitter. You know, he would give me a hard time sometimes about my socks. JJ was an acute fashion maven. So any comments that I got about socks from JJ, I really took as a badge. You know, he was just a genuine person and a genuinely nice person. And I think we're all feeling a little bit emptier because we don't have him to connect with because he connected with everybody.
Yeah, you're so right, Kevin. So, Ryan, you broke a story earlier this week about an attorney who was fired from the Idaho Attorney General's office. She's saying she was retaliated against. Fill us in on this.
Sure. First of all, hi, Gemma. Thanks for having me. As you mentioned, former Deputy Attorney General, name is Daphne Wong. She was fired back in March. And in this new lawsuit filed last week, she says she was wrongfully fired. And she points to an Idaho law that's essentially whistleblower protection. It says public employees can't fire someone for raising concerns that their boss did something wrong. And what Wong did was back in March, a couple months preceding, she was the attorney for the Department of Health and Welfare, which your listeners may know is sort of embroiled in some investigations, possible legal action concerning the Attorney General's office. But the rub is, and Kevin can probably speak to this too, because there's something similar happening with the State Board of Education. Attorney General Labrador is the attorney for state agencies and their officials, which means they are bound by certain ethical rules and legal rules that say an attorney is supposed to look out for their client. And what happened with Daphne Wong, she wrote a legal opinion that what's called the Executive Office of the Attorney General didn't agree with. And she had some meetings with some high-level executive officials from the office who sort of urged her to side with them in this investigation into the Department of Health and Welfare, which has to do with child care grants. And after that meeting, Wong wrote a pretty scathing letter accusing Labrador and the people in his office of acting unethically. And about 3 hours later, she was fired. And she's now filed this lawsuit that says that was retaliation for her bringing up these concerns, essentially.
So where is the lawsuit right now, Ryan?
It's pretty fresh. Okay. I can't say. When I wrote my story, the Attorney General hadn't even seen it yet. So still very fresh.
Okay. Kevin, keeping with the Attorney General theme, and as Ryan mentioned, they're embroiled in a lot of lawsuits right now. One being with the State Board of Education. What's going on here?
Kind of an interesting development here, Gemma. As you know, the Attorney General filed this lawsuit against the State Board back in June. He alleges that the State Board violated open meeting law when they discussed the University of Idaho's plan to purchase the University of Phoenix behind closed doors in a series of closed door meetings. The lawsuit has taken an interesting turn these past couple of weeks. Labrador and his staff have filed subpoenas, and they've demanded depositions of every member of the State Board of Education, all eight members, State Board staff, University of Phoenix staff, and representatives of Titan Partners, which is the firm that Phoenix hired to help broker the sale. So a bunch of subpoenas, a bunch of depositions, very far-reaching, and that's the crux of the latest filing from the State Board of Education's hired lawyer. She has filed a motion to basically try to quash this process. It's called a motion for a protective order. Now, that's not a criminal protective order, nothing like that, but it is a protective order that says these are overly far-reaching, they're invasive, it's harassment through the legal discovery process. We've not gotten a response yet from Labrador. I expect that he will file a response. I'm keeping an eye out for that. But it just kind of underscores this ongoing legal battle between the Attorney General, who's elected mm-hmm. to serve as legal representative for state agencies, including health and welfare, including in this case, the State Board of Education. And in this case, the State Board having to hire an outside attorney because they needed an independent attorney to go against the Attorney General's office, who has obviously brought this lawsuit. So this case is a long way from being resolved. And as I could see from the documents, it's getting a little bit more testy.
Just a little bit. That's a good way of putting it, Kevin, for sure.
And I'll just add to what Kevin said.
Yeah.
It's worth noting that I think these cases are pretty unprecedented. We don't really know what happens when the Attorney General takes action against people he's supposed to represent. But what we've seen is courts have sort of said so far the Attorney General should recuse himself from these things because he may have knowledge of the case, that sort of thing.
Unprecedented, absolutely. It is. I think it's going to be very interesting to see how all of these turn out. Let's switch gears a bit. Gretchen, let me bring you into the conversation. So the Idaho Transportation Building and all of the land that it was on is on State Street in Boise. And we finally know now who's buying the land. So Gretchen, tell us about that. And then what are the plans for it? Because this is a big piece of property.
Yeah, big piece of property and prime real estate, 44 acres along the Boise River. So it hit the market in May. And ITD announced this week that a group of companies, they had the highest bid. It was Hawkins Companies, Pacific Companies, and FJ Management. They didn't disclose how much that they proposed to buy the property for, but I imagine it's a lot. They don't have set plans yet, but they said most likely they'll develop the property to be a combination of multifamily, commercial, and a retail element. But before the deal is final, they're going to take, once they have more of an idea what they want to do with the area, they're going to take their plans to the city of Boise and see if the city of Boise says it's feasible. Then they'll, then the deal will be done because they'll likely have to rezone the area depending on what they want to do with it. So we'll have to see exactly what they're going to do. But yeah, they said most likely mm-hmm. a mix of multifamily, commercial, and retail.
But I'm assuming, Gretchen, this is kind of years in the works, right?
Yes, it'll. That's another thing, too. They haven't announced like a timeline. But yeah, this will be a years long project.
Okay, Rachel, so what's going on with the Bureau of Land Management here in Idaho? They have a new plan to manage renewable energy projects. Why do they need a new plan for this? And I guess, what is the plan?
Yeah, so the stage was kind of set for this new plan earlier this winter and spring when the Bureau of Land Management hosted 3 in-person open houses in Idaho to gather people's opinions about renewable energy developments. The Lava Ridge Wind Project, which is proposed for the Magic Valley, it would be Idaho's largest wind farm. When it was first proposed in 2018, it was actually the first renewable energy project proposal the BLM in Idaho had received. Now, just 5 years later, there are 14 in the works at various stages of the application process. And, that's in part because the BLM nationally has a goal, an objective to permit 25 gigawatts of renewable energy on public lands by 2025. And it's also because some parts of Idaho are well suited for wind and solar development. And there are transmission lines that are here or that are planned that could carry this energy elsewhere in the West. And so really the growth of applications in the past few years has increased the workload for agency staff here. And, you know, the offices have not grown to keep up with that demand. And also what the agency had been seeing in the Lava Ridge Wind Project is, you know, the prime example of this is that when the projects are proposed and people have a lot of input that they want to give on the project, and sometimes there are, you know, conflicts between people who are currently using that land, like, you know, ranchers who have grazing permits there, and also, you know, other nearby sites like the Minidoka National Historic Site, that can prompt a lot of conflict during the federal process that is designed to review these projects. And so what the agency in Idaho is trying to do is to have some of those discussions before it even reaches that national federal review process, and to get companies and developers who want to put renewable energy projects here in Idaho on public lands to start engaging with people that that might have, you know, issues with the development ahead of time. And so one aspect of this strategy is a new report that developers will have to fill out to kind of show that they are thinking about these topics and that they've looked at the place where the project might go and that they know what's happening there. They know if there are threatened species nearby, and if there are recreational uses, you know. So I think it's similar to the topics that are covered already by the review process. But what the agency here wants to do is kind of push those conversations to the beginning of the review process, which could actually end up factoring into which ones are considered or move forward over others.
Okay. Ryan and Christina, where are we in terms of will there or won't there be a special legislative session? Ryan, let's begin the conversation with you, because why is this even an issue for folks who may not be following this closely?
Well, I could tell you, you could keep your weekend plans most likely, because it's probably not going to happen. But there's a lot going on, but I'll try to give my radio explanation as briefly as I can.
All right, appreciate that.
I think what people need to know basically is earlier this year, the legislature passed a bill to move the primary election from March to May. Idea being, and sorry, this is just for president, presidential primary right. From March to May. Idea being all other primary elections are in May. We could save some money and improve voter turnout because a lot of people show up and vote in the presidential primary. This bill passed, and then they figured out there was something wrong. They forgot to add a portion that allows candidates to file for the election. So in essence, they eliminated the primary altogether. There was a trailer bill, just a follow-up bill, separate one, to fix the error. The Senate passed it, and it failed in the House. And it failed in the House after Dorothy Moon, chairwoman of the state GOP, showed up to the legislature and said, hang on, we haven't been consulted on this. We don't want to move the primary to May. And so the trailer bill ultimately failed. And that basically left us with parties deciding what they're going to do about the primary election next year. And what they decided on was caucuses. And legislators have since said, we don't much care for caucuses because basically less people can participate in a caucus than an election. People who are out of town, serving in the military, on a mission, during a regular primary, they can vote absentee. But you got to be there in a caucus to participate. So legislators said, let's get back together and fix this so we can have a primary election next year and people can show up. This second thing you need to understand is the legislature can call itself into session, but most lawmakers need to agree on what they're going to do. Idea behind that is let's not waste our time and money coming down to Boise from all over the state if we're not going to get anything done. Mm-hmm. So the Senate came up with a proposal to basically do what they tried to do during this legislative session, which was move the presidential primary to May. The House came up with a competing proposal, which was to reinstate the March primary. And they haven't come to an agreement. And it's rather urgent because the Republican National Committee needs to know what the plans are for the primary by Sunday, this Sunday, October 1st.
Oh, so, okay. So Christina, with that said, if the Republican National folks need to know by this Sunday, does that mean they would have to go into session this weekend, or can they make a plan and let them know?
Yes. So it's our understanding that they really do need to have this figured out by Sunday. Representative Brent Crane, who is the chairman of one of the committees that these bills would come through, has said that, you know, he's willing to show up on Saturday or Sunday. The Republican National Party isn't working on Sunday. So he believes that even on Sunday, they could come in, do the special session and submit those plans to the National Party. But that October 1st deadline is not flexible, according to the chairwoman, Dorothy Moon, and some of these other legislators that have been looking at this issue. And I really want to go back to a point that Ryan made about the participation in a caucus. In 2012, the Republicans held a presidential caucus and 44,000 people participated. In 2016, when the Republican Party switched to a primary election, 225,000 voters were able to participate. And so this really is, I think, an urgent issue for all of these legislators. I think it's a shame that they can't figure out a path forward so far, because I think we really will see less Idahoans being able to put their vote forward for who they think should be president. So, you know, we're waiting and able to cover any sort of legislative session that happens this weekend. But we truly are running out of runway with that October 1st deadline staring us in the face on Sunday.
Yeah, sounds like it. Kevin, I think it's fair to say that there's lots of drama coming out of North Idaho when it comes to education. So let's begin with the West Bonner School District, because has there been any movement on what to do about the superintendent, but also these two vacant trustee positions?
Well, first of all, I want to piggyback on that previous conversation. In my view, every legislative session is a special legislative session in its own way. So, you know, if they meet this weekend, great. If not, we'll wait till January. But okay, West Bonner. Let's go to West Bonner, because why not? So a lot of news out of West Bonner this week. Brandon Durst tendered his resignation on Monday after a couple of pretty tumultuous months as superintendent. It's not clear exactly when he will step down. We'll watch and see when that unfolds. The Board of Trustees met briefly on Wednesday, and they met long enough just to accept and declare that they have two vacancies on the board. If you remember back in August, two board members were recalled. The board had to meet and had not met until Wednesday to say, yeah, we have a couple of vacancies. So one of the trustees who had missed a previous meeting literally phoned it in. He called from the road to participate in the meeting long enough to allow for the vote that, yes, there are two vacancies on that five-member Board of Trustees. And of course, you have to bear in mind that the three trustees that are still in office, they're all on the ballot in November. So the saga in West Bonner is not done yet.
No, it doesn't seem like it. Not even close.
Never.
So let's stay with North Idaho, Kevin, because what's going on with North Idaho College?
Another never-ending story, right? North Idaho College trustees met this week And the topic was about the censure of one of their own. Terry Zimmerman is one of the five trustees on that community college board. And this all goes back to August. It goes back to a brief meeting of the board of trustees to authorize their attorney to try to enter into a settlement with a former employee. It's unclear how much money that former employee could receive. Zimmerman said in the meeting, we could be talking about a $1.3 million settlement. So the discussion about that settlement and the amount of money, that was the crux of this meeting on Wednesday with the NIC board. Did Zimmerman disclose classified information in an open session, presumably when she mentioned that potential dollar figure? Ultimately, the Board of Trustees voted not to censure Zimmerman. They actually voted unanimously not to censure her. And it's kind of rare for NIC trustees to vote unanimously on anything. But there's still a lot of disagreement within the board. Did Zimmerman release confidential information? The chair of the board, Greg McKenzie, insists that she has done this on a couple of occasions. Zimmerman denies it. There's still a lot of rancor on that Board of Trustees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to say the least. So, Christina, fill us in on what's being called a crisis in Idaho's direct care workforce.
Yes. So about this time last week, the legislature's committee met to learn about a report that's been recently released in February about Idaho's direct care workforce. And these are the folks that come into people's homes, help take care of people with disabilities, help them do daily tasks like take a shower or do laundry, these sort of things, other medical appointments, and so on. The Office of Performance Evaluations for the state of Idaho found that we're like down 3,000 of these types of workers compared to national staffing levels. And so there's a real concern among the folks in our disabled community that there's just not enough of these workers to go around. And part of the problem is that these workers who are primarily paid by Idaho Medicaid, that they're just not making enough money to stay into these jobs. The mm-hmm. typical nursing assistant in direct care made $14.16 per hour, the report found. And these workers could earn 39% more by leaving direct care. And so, you know, the Idaho Council on Developmental Disabilities is really looking at this and saying, you know, this council is working on this every day, but we also need the legislature to help with some of these Medicaid reimbursements and raise those wages for these workers so that we can have these people in these homes. You know, it's basically this way of keeping Idahoans in their homes and not having to go into assisted living facilities and things like that. So mm-hmm. This is all part of this big discussion on Idaho Medicaid, you know, which that state budget has just grown and grown and grown over the last few years. And the legislature is looking hard at how do we rein in some of these costs when it comes to Idaho Medicaid. So, you know, we have this really intense crisis, this problem where we're not getting enough people who are not paid enough to stay into this line of work. And we have the legislature saying, we need to reduce these Idaho Medicaid costs. So they're in competition with each other. And we'll see if the legislature takes into account some of these testimonies and this report that we've seen and see what they can do to help alleviate some of these problems.
Ryan, fill us in on this Idaho high school football coach who is coming under some pressure, and this has to do with some political beliefs, one being that he tweeted something, correct, that said people should be executed if they are found to be guilty of voter fraud?
Yeah, so just to kind of provide some context, I mean,
yeah,
this football coach's name is Jerome Bell. He was hired back in March, I believe. And we at the paper saw a story in another local outlet about this new coach, and it wasn't me, but I think someone on staff just kind of Googled his name. And it turned out that he actually ran for Congress last year in Virginia. Actually, two of the last cycles he ran for Congress in Virginia in 2020 and 2022. Obviously not successful, but he did make a lot of headlines for some of things he said while he was campaigning, including that people engaged in voter fraud, convicted of voter fraud, should be executed. He said, you know, that's, he believes that's treason and that's the appropriate punishment for treason. So yeah, we published a story last week just to kind of let people know that the football coach has fairly extreme views. And I chatted with him and he assured me that he doesn't talk about politics with his players. He doesn't curse at his players. So, yeah.
And you did, I mean, your organization did interview him, right? I mean, and he did say, you know, these are his beliefs, but as you mentioned, he keeps them off of the field.
Yeah, he certainly didn't back away from anything he said. I think he's still believes the things that he's said, but very strongly told us that that's about politics and I'm here to coach football. That was his response for the most part. Yeah.
So Kevin, Idaho Launch is I guess what launching next month. For folks who aren't familiar, what is it? But also, what does this mean for Idaho students?
Well, next week actually is a big.
Oh, next week. Okay.
Yeah, it's a big milestone for Idaho Launch. Now, this is the program we talked a lot about this during the session. This is a program that's going to provide grants for high school graduates of up to $8,000 that they can use to go to community college. They can go get career technical education. They can get job training. All tied to in-demand careers, jobs that are hard to fill for employers and careers where there are a lot of vacancies. So on October 3rd, that's when the application period opens. So this is, it's going to be really interesting. And I'm working on a piece that I'll hopefully have up next week, looking at how does this play out on Tuesday when this application window opens, what happens with kids? I mean, how many high school seniors jump in and apply? What sort of interest is there in this program? What sort of demand is there for the money? There's a lot of money on the table. It's $75 million or so that's available for students to get in the way of launch grants. So a lot to work out. And I'm trying to talk to some high school counselors to get a sense of, you know, what are they hearing from parents? What are they hearing from students? What are they, you know, what are their questions about this brand new program as it gets ready to get started? So we'll have more coverage of that coming up next week. Mm-hmm.
So Kevin, if I'm understanding this right, as you said, this would be up to $8,000 and this is for training for these in-demand careers. So so does that mean they have to use it for education and it has to then be that they would be studying one of these fields? I was looking at, and I asked this because I was looking at these, and you have this on your website. There's a list of 242 in-demand occupations, and it ranges from things like nurses to teachers, I mean, bartenders, you know, cooks, things like that. So it would be specific to these, you know, 200 plus occupations.
And that's kind of one of the questions that is still, I still have, that I'm not sure has really completely been vetted out yet. How does that work? I mean, obviously the emphasis is on students wanting a job training and some of those 240 some in-demand careers where there are a lot of jobs and there's a need for training. So there are hot jobs in Idaho that you don't need any training beyond high school to get. So how much, you know, what happens if there is money left over? Is there money that's available for students to go to community college just to take some, you know, some gen ed classes, some general education classes? I think there's a lot to kind of, you know, that's why I want to talk to some counselors and get a sense of, you know, how is this all going to play out on the ground? And, you know, as I say, we're going to get some answers here pretty quickly.
And they have to, if they were to go, let's say, to a community college or something like that, I'm assuming this, they would have to stay in state, or do we know?
Yes, that? It's all for in-state programs. That's something I can't answer definitively. Yeah, if a student wants to use their launch money, they have to use it at a college or a CTE program or a job training program within the state.
Okay. Thank you for that. And so, so next week is when the application process opens up for people who have been kind of waiting for this.
Right. The application window for high school seniors opens on Tuesday. They won't get grants necessarily until spring or summer. They, you know, you have to graduate high school, first of all, to qualify for the grants. What will happen over the next couple of months is students will get pre-approved for their share of the money.
And is this an annual program, Kevin? Because I know the governor said, you know, he hopes they run out of money, you know, basically saying we hope, you know, so many kids take us up on this. So is this a one-time thing or is this going to be annual?
No, it's ongoing. That is part of the money that was earmarked in that special session. Like I say, they're all special sessions, right? When the legislature met in September of last September and put aside $410 million for education, some of that money, $80 million, was set aside for what has now become the Idaho Launch Program. So yes, it's ongoing money.
Okay. Gretchen, before we wrap up, we've got a couple of minutes here to talk about some closures in Boise's restaurant scene.
Yeah, there's been quite a bit recently. So I'll start off with Sea Crab House. That's in downtown on 8th Street. That's in the Zions Bank building. It took over the former Flatbread Pizza on the second story. They just opened in July and they are now closed. They're temporarily closed. I spoke with the president of the company and he said that it's a staffing issue. And he said, as soon as they rehire and retrain, then they'll eventually reopen, but there's no set opening date. And the popular Boise Food Finds group, people have been complaining about the prices of that restaurant because they specialize in seafood boils and the boils range from $100 to $200. They feed two people. But that's not exactly cheap. Yeah. So the president of the company, he didn't say if that was a factor, but it could be. They have other locations in Oregon and Washington. So we'll see if this one reopens. And then Zeppeli, the bakery and popular lunch spot, they also just closed their downtown location on 8th Street. The owner, I spoke with him, Charles, he plans to reopen. Also a staffing issue. He said that he had two employees that basically ran that store and they quit without notice over the weekend. Oh. And at their Apple location, they have another bakery on Apple Street in Boise. They were already short-staffed there, so they had no employees to spare. And unfortunately, he had to close the downtown shop. And he says as soon as he hires more employees, he's hopeful that he will reopen that as well.
And I need to wrap up. I appreciate all of your time. Thank you so much to all of our reporters. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now, we're taking center stage. Introducing NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of Black-led stories from NPR's podcasts. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get your podcasts.